Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 11, Shooting the Breeze with Giaconetti. We recently talked with Luke Giaconetti for about 2 hours, ostensibly for a feedback episode, and some parts of that conversation were actually related to feedback. But there was so much good stuff in the wild tangents that we took that we didn't want to lose it.
Consider this episode the deleted scenes, extended scenes, and outtakes from episode 10. We talk about podcasting, Godzilla, of course, The Equalizer, Doctor Who, and action figures. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
I'm eating cereal.
I was considering briefly. It said, you know, the Amazon link did say, people who looked at this also looked at, and you'll have to correct me on the name, Luke. Super Samurai Cyber Squad?
Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad.
Well, oh, God.
How could I have gotten that wrong?
Well, ridiculous name aside, that is a show based on a Kyodai hero, a giant hero show called Gridman, also made by Tsuburaya in the 90s. And Gridman and Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad have essentially the same premise. And it's one of these great elevator pitch, high concept premises. It's Ultraman meets Tron.
Hmm.
So your monsters are now viruses in a digital world, and your hero is a digital computer program that goes and fights the viruses.
Cool.
It's actually not bad. That is going to be the topic on the next episode of Earth Destruction Directive as of this recording. And the great thing about Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad is that the show is so formulaic that literally you can roll a dice and pick an episode at random, and that will probably be an episode that will explain the entire concept to you, and you'll understand the show completely.
Well, there's something to be said for that.
It's taking the Stan Lee philosophy, any episode could be a person's first episode, is that?
Yeah, well, it's got one of those great theme songs that tells you.
Ah!
Yes! Excellent.
But
when was this show made? Because I'm vaguely feeling 2002.
1994.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
Right at the beginning of Power Rangers.
Yeah. Even a huge thing. Huh.
Well, you know, remember 1993 was the first season of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers,
right. And
Ranger Mania kind of hit hard. So you got shows like Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad, VR Troopers, which was Saban ripping off itself, which was kind of funny.
That's amazing.
We got Tattoo Teenage Alien Fighters from Beverly Hills, also available on DVD now.
Okay, I was going to say, Dad, if you buy me Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad, I'm going to be a little disappointed in you. No, if you get me whatever the hell that was.
Well, Emily, I don't know if this will influence whether you like the show or not, but Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad does star Matthew Lawrence, younger brother of Joey Lawrence.
I care not for either of those people.
Just
I have no idea who they are.
Well, you know, just throwing it out there for what it's worth. When I was growing up, Joey Lawrence, all the older girls loved him, and the younger girls loved Matthew Lawrence because he was the younger brother.
All right. Well, just as a reminder, when the first season of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers came out, I was 2 years old. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
I have no idea who these people are.
Fair enough. What do you, well...
Kids these days, Luke. Kids these days. But I also have to say, probably, certainly the greatest title of a podcast episode ever. Maybe my favorite podcast episode ever for content was you and the Irredeemable Shag. With Doctor Who X Ultraman Big Dueling Showdown Across Time and Space, the appearance of Time Lord Alien the Doctor.
Yes, and that started out as Shag and I just had an epiphany over last summer that basically Ultraman and Doctor Who are the same show. And the biggest Doctor Who fan I know is Irredeemable Shag. And so I just sent him an email and we were talking back and forth about doing the show and he said, "Why do these Japanese things always have such crazy titles?" And I said, well, you know, it's because the nature of the way that katakana is translated into English is that
Yeah. Things
are very, you know, adjectives don't always translate exactly, so they tend to be very bombastic. And says, well, I've got to do a crazy title for this then.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, I just threw as many as in there as I could.
Yeah, but my favorite part of that, there's at one point, I wish I remember what it was called, but it was something, you know, you asked Shag, so have you ever heard of,
and
you
it give the... It was Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad. Yeah,
it may have been. But... So have you ever heard of Superhuman Samurai Cyber Squad? And he goes, no! With disdain, disgust.
Confusion, horror.
On the, well, at the night we're recording this, the... circling around the internet right now is the mini episode Night of the Doctor, which is the prologue to the Day of the Doctor film, the anniversary film for Doctor Who.
I watched it today, Emily. Did you?
I have not seen it yet. Spoilers.
No fear. I won't say it just for your benefit. But I did go on the Two True Freaks Facebook group and say I like the part when the Baltons showed up. Tell you what, nobody's expecting that. Everyone's saying, oh, will the Ninth Doctor show up? Will the Eighth Doctor show up? Yeah, well, when Ultra 7 shows up, it's going to hit the fan right there. Nobody's going to see that coming.
When they finally reveal the existence of Torchwood East or Torchwood Tokyo, then we'll be set.
You know, Captain Jack would have looked great in that orange jumpsuit. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I agree.
Captain Jack looks great in everything.
Yeah, you know.
This is your show, Dad.
What?
I'm just your comedy sidekick.
What do you
let's see?
Last Action Hero?
Maybe.
I'm a comedy sidekick.
I would never play chicken with a car because I know that in the bike versus car always wins.
Yeah, we call that the law of gross tonnage.
Yeah, I thought that was a great catch, and I'm a little bit older than you, so what I one of the things I like about Person of Interest is that it harkens back to the greatest show of the 80s, The Equalizer, which unfortunately has some rights issues, similar to, say, ROM, in terms of the reason ROM has never been collected is because no one exactly quite knows who owns what. And until Marvel buys everything, or Disney buys everything.
Yeah.
You know, between the toys and the original story, the character versus the story versus the comics, no one quite knows who has the rights to reprint what. And in the case of The Equalizer, a lot of it was the 80s music.
Yeah.
That they would drop in, you know, with a popular song of the day, never thinking, because it didn't exist, home video market or DVD, and you'd have to pay royalties every time. So you get these weird legal situations.
Something very similar happened to one of my favorite shows of all time, which is WKRP in Cincinnati.
Right, right. Because the music is such an important part of that, either the plot or the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that Daredevil movie is not as bad as many people think.
I agree. I personally like it, but I think because I'm not such a hardcore Daredevil fan, I may be a little more prone.
We have the director's cut. I should sit down and watch it at some point.
Yeah.
But it's just, I heard enough bad things that I was not at all interested. And then 9 months later, you bought the DVD and I just never bothered to check it out. But I really should.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting point, Luke. I think part of the problem with that movie and others is Daredevil's a movie my wife liked.
Right.
And if they're reaching non-comic book people, they're probably having to make enough changes that are going to turn off the hardcore comic book people.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but the scopes are so different. I mean, this the sheer magnitude. The movies and even the TV shows have to reach beyond the comic book crowd. You know, yeah. Comic book is a hit at 60,000 units. Right. It's a big hit at 150,000 units. TV show at 3 million is in danger of cancellation. Right. And you need 10 million people spending $10 each to get a $100 million movie. The Green Lantern movie, which is considered a bomb, had probably 12 to 13 million people go to it.
Right.
But that's not enough. That would be a top 25 TV show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that many people, and obviously it's about 1,000 times what a comic book sells. All right. Are we ready? Clear your throats.
I believe so.
Let's get to this. Ready. 3, 2. Let me put on my radio announcer podcast voice.
Please stop.
Why?
No.
It's been 22 and a half years. You've never heard that voice. Come on.
Oh, that's got to
put you at ease, right? Okay, you ready, Em? Ready, Luke?
Here, one sec. I'm going to close the door because I can actually hear you through the hall. One sec.
That's not good.
All right.
I joke with Emily, one of my favorite parts in a podcast, and we haven't done it yet in about 20 episodes, is that part where you're listening to a podcast, and the one guy says, don't worry, I'll cut that out.
Cut that out.
So far, we've actually done that every time we said it. So
the only one that's worse is, make sure you cut that out.
Yeah, make sure you, I can't say this. Make sure you cut that out. I've actually heard that on podcasts, so. Emily and I are usually in the same room on the same microphone.
Yeah, so this is going to be interesting.
Yeah, so we usually know to not talk over each other. You can sort of tell. It's harder with three at different locations. So, but we will cut stuff out.
Oh, no problem. Just, on the vault, we normally just shout over each other. And that's
well, that's a horror podcast. You're supposed to do that. I think that's expected.
Yeah.
It's supposed to sound like an auditory slaughterhouse.
And I'm thinking, Honeywell, Tyler, I don't know, you and Sean, politeness just isn't the word that comes to mind. I'm just saying.
Well, Sean is. That's
that is true. That is true.
A lot of people are eager for us to be finished with the Italian primer just so that I will shut up a little bit, because the Italian thing was all my idea. That's why I introduced those episodes. I picked the movies. You know, I pick the order. I do all the notes. So it's like, it's kind of like, yeah, Luke watches Fulci and Argento for a year. So,
it's Luke watches movies and he drags a couple of his friends along.
Yeah, but at least they for the most part liked them. So
yeah, you know, because we always talk, you know, Earth Destruction Directive when we mention you, but when we introduce you, you know, throw in everything, throw in Hawkman, throw in the bunker, even though I know that's not active, but throw in whatever you want to for,
all right,
for promotion.
A character like Cage, who is someone who has had things taken from him his whole life. You know, he didn't have a great upbringing. He was on the street. He was accused of a crime he didn't commit. He went to jail for a crime he didn't commit. He's a fugitive from the law after breaking out of prison and being accused of killing the warden, which he did not do. You know, he's the reason why Luke Cage, his office is in Midtown Manhattan, was because he was afraid to go back to Harlem and be recognized. So that's why he changed his name and stayed in Manhattan. You know, this guy who's this curmudgeon, this guy who everything has been dumped on him his whole life. And any Luke Cage comic you read is him getting, you know, the world just pouring on his head constantly until that last couple of pages, that arthritic release of Mace or Stiletto or Discus or Mr. Fish or whomever. And it's all just, just let it out. And who can't relate to that? When Christopher Priest, as under his name of Jim Owsley, was writing the book towards the very end, he had Luke said a very famous line where he said, oh, she didn't buy my loud, angry Negro act. And at the time, it was like, that was like, whoa, wait a minute, that's an act? And it's like, we just thought he was being just a stereotypical angry black guy. And he's like, yeah, he was. It was an act of being angry, stereotypical black guy. Huh. Because as a big, burly, tough guy, that got him information that he wanted. And that was like a revolution right before the book was canceled.
Oh.
As they seem to be.
Yeah. You know, it's when the books can go one of two ways. They can either, you know, when the writing's on the wall, it means either the editor doesn't care so much, you can get away with more stuff, or it means your massive plans that you just started all get dashed and have to be reverted because we need to use this character as a guest star. I mentioned that I was reading the 90s Morbius, which as a general rule, I really enjoyed. I mean, very much a horror superhero book. You know, Morbius being the living vampire, his book doesn't exactly lend itself well to bright, sunny adventures. But towards the end of it, the new writer came in with right before the book was canceled, had this big story going on where Morbius was cured of his bloodlust and he looked normal again, and you know, he didn't have the big fangs and all that, and then the book ends and he has to like revert back to being himself in the span of 22 pages as we desperately try to wrap everything up because wait a minute, we still need Morbius for other guest spots. And he needs to be a vampire.
There's only so much you can do with a character. It all ties back to maybe reboots and retcons too. There has to be some sort of status quo.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you mean Morbius is the living vampire. If he's not that, what is he? And I mean that in a serious sense. I mean that's how the character is defined. Was that he was a tragic figure who was a vampire created by science. And that's what his stories revolved around, was him trying to find a cure for himself. So if you don't have that story engine, if Morbius is cured, why are we reading about him? If Luke Cage is not the hero for hire, if he's not open for business, he's just a guy in an office that's not taking clients, why are we reading about it? You know, if
you're saying my pitch for a James Bond insurance salesman might not...
Well, that depends. Is he selling policies to Blofeld and Jaws?
Because that would be awesome.
I don't know that. Think about that. These supervillains, they build these giant installations. They've got thousands of men in jumpsuits working for them. They have to provide insurance at some point, right? I mean, if there's no dental plan, would you go? You know, would you skip out working for Blofeld and go work for the Kingpin instead or something? You know.
This is basically unrelated, but one of the best episodes of Kim Possible handled that, where the big bad ends up broke working out of a van or somebody's garage because all of his employees at the same time filed insurance claims for repeatedly getting punched in the face by Kim Possible, and he went bankrupt. I'm like, that's the greatest.
You don't think about these things. They don't teach you this at supervillain school.
It's that setup that I think is what makes one of the best, if not the best, superhero movie ever is The Incredibles.
Yes.
It starts with that exact premise.
The Incredibles also has the ultimate reason not to make fun of the Trapster, a.k.a. Pace Pot Pete.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everybody makes fun of Pace Pot Pete because he had a stupid name, and his gimmick was that he had a really sticky glue gun. Seems kind of laughable. Well, watch that scene in Syndrome's computer room with the sentry guns.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not equipped to deal with really sticky glue.
Since we lost my idea of turning Galaxy Quest into a comic book, I'm going to pitch now the Frozone comic.
Yes.
That's...
Yes.
I found my replacement. And Dave Walker, if you find it already exists...
I this is such a cliche, but anytime I can't find something, like the kid's jacket or my shoes or something, I will yell them up, "Where's my super suit?" And I'll say, "It's on the floor." And my wife is gracious, like, "Great or good, I am your wife. I'm the greatest good you ever gonna know."
It's nice to have enablers. My wife, Emily's mom, does her best to tolerate us, I think, at our truly geekiest.
Well, like I said, I will say that at one point my wife did ask me, "Luke, why do you have so many Ultramans?" And I said, "Oh, it's like, you know, it's like, well, this is Ultraman, this is Ultra 7, this is Ultraman Jack, and this Ultraman Taro, and this Ultraman Leo, and this Ultraman 80, and this Ultraman Tiga, and this Ultraman Dinah, and this is Ultraman Gaia, and this is Ultraman, you know." Straight down the line, she's like, "Yeah, why are there so many of them, though? They all pretty much look alike."
I was going to say, at what point did the eyes glaze over in the list?
I think Ultra 7. That was to be fair, she understands Ultraman, Ultra 7. Once you start getting into some of the later ones, though, it's like, why? And then it's like, oh, and this is Ultraman Taro's dad. His name is Father of Ultra. It's like real creative.
His name is
Mother of Ultra.
Emily, I'm pretty sure Mom left the room whenever we broke out the Ultraman DVDs. Is that your recollection as well? You may have as well.
I left the room when you broke out the Ultraman DVDs.
Yeah, well, that I did put on the nostalgia goggles for that one.
I only came back for the episode with the diamonds and the starfish and the And the car driving into the backdrop. That's the only episode I ever
saw. Okay, the car driving into the backdrop is one of my all-time favorites. But I'll have to...
I'm just going to say, you got to watch Earth is My Home.
Yes.
I know.
Yes, we did. Yeah. Yeah, after you mentioned that recently,
I'm serious. I've watched a lot of Daikaiju in my day. I've never seen a Daikaiju story make me cry until I watched Earth is My Home. That is just so harsh. Especially, you know, it's like, oh, man. Again. But next episode, we got another monster to fight, so let's move it along, people.
And I know I know at some point early in our correspondence, Luke, I must have come across as a real dope. Because at one point I referred to Ultraman as that great black and white goodness of my youth. And then when I got the DVDs, I should have... And saw, oh yeah, there was orange. I do vaguely remember that. But I just think it's most of the time I was watching it on the black and white TV in my bedroom.
I'm in the same boat because I had a black and white TV in my bedroom for a number of years. So
I mean, you'd think if I'd seen the orange jumpsuit once, I'd never forget it. But I did notice a trend in a lot of your ideas, Luke. Between the ones we've talked about so far, and you mentioned some Charles Bronson movies. I mean, if we need to make this an intervention as well as a discussion, that's fine, but...
You know, the other day on a news group I was on, I was saying other shows Marvel could do like this, and all my shows, I was like, oh, they could do Werewolf by Night, and Jack Russell could be on the road trying to find the Darkhold. I said... They could do Ghost Rider, and Johnny Blaze would be on the road trying to find... Why do all my content have guys traveling the open road? They could do U1 and have... And I was like, no, just stop right there.
Do we need to drop in the Incredible Hulk music here at this point? The Bill Bixby music?
The sad walking away.
Now...
All kidding aside, Werewolf by Night. You want to talk about an elevator pitch? Guy living the good life in Malibu, California, on his 18th birthday, discovers that his father, because his father had a curse put on him, turns into a werewolf. Now he's got to go find this book to find the cure. That's a TV show right there. And a werewolf in California, that's different in and of itself.
Teen Wolf Surfer Dude.
I'd watch it.
Well, I mean, I said I'm a big fan of the war properties. Every November, in honor of Veterans Day, I try to read a lot of war comics. I previously had run a promotion called War Comics Month, where I used Twitter and other social networks to try and drum up interest in reading war comics as a tribute to our veterans and our active servicemen and servicewomen. And you know, that war comics get kind of a bum rap. And there are a lot of lousy war comics out there, but you know, they're not all just jackbooted and jingoistic. There's the majority, especially at DC, the majority of the people who worked on those books were veterans themselves.
Right.
So there's a coda at the end of pretty much every DC war book. It's a little circular icon that says "Make War No More."
Hmm.
And so these were men that they knew what war was about. And they never, especially under guys like Joe Orlando and when Bob Kaniger moved over to being the editor, they didn't shy away from showing the impacts of war. Unknown Soldier was very good for that because it was on such a small scale. It often showed the personal impact of war. Sergeant Rock was also very good for this, in that showing that it's war is not this glamorous, glorious thing. This is down in the dirt, in the mud. Hoping to, you know, are you going to survive to see the next sunrise? So, and you know, that's a personal interest of mine that just is a hard sell nowadays. You know, the Vertigo Unknown Soldier book from a couple of years ago really got it good. It was set in Uganda and dealt with the child soldiers and the it was hard to read. It was so accurate that it was upsetting to read it, and I had to like read that and then like go read Tiny Titans to like cleanse my brain.
I mean,
it's like, if I sit and I think about this, I'll get so upset, you know, that I'm going to give myself agita here.
You know, I like to fancy myself as someone who is willing to read outside of the superhero, genre in terms of sci-fi comics and fantasy and some of the lighter side of horror, but I admit the war comics are a total blind spot for me.
I will say that DC has been very, very good about putting their war comics into the showcase format, the large-scale black and white.
Oh, right.
And, I mean, they've put out 4 volumes of Sergeant Rock. They've put out The Unknown Soldier, The Haunted Tank, Enemy Ace. Enemy Ace was a real kind of revolutionary strip because, first off, it took place in World War I, right, which was very unusual considering most of them took place in World War II. And the main character, Hans von Hammer, was a German pilot. And it was this idea that, again, like we were talking about earlier with some of the Soviet and communist characters, that here was a guy, he's the enemy, but he's portrayed as an actual person. He's not a caricature. Hans von Hammer is German and fights for the German cause in World War I, but he's not a goose-stepping moron, like Sean Connery said in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. He's portrayed as an honorable individual who's doing what's the right thing for himself and his country. And so that book was very revolutionary at the time. But then they've done some of the Men of War. I think the Our Army at War book collects all the one-off short stories and stuff like right. that. So they've done a very good job of preserving those and getting them into a very easy to read and easy to digest format. The fact that Joe Kubert worked on so many of them, that his stuff looks fantastic in black and white, is just icing on the cake as far as I'm concerned. I could read black and white Joe Kubert stuff all day long. I probably wouldn't like that, but
the closest I've gotten to war comics has really been the last month or so, listening to Tom Paneris with the In Country, the Nom. So that's really the closest that's probably the most exposure I've had to war comics, and it's whatever 3 or 4 hours of his podcast.
The Nom's a good book too.
Yeah, it sounds like it from what he's saying.
And you did pick up an issue, didn't you? We just had our quarter bin sale around here, so we went and picked up some new material for Dad's podcast.
Yeah, I did. I did pick up an issue of The Nom, so I'm looking forward to reading it. And Tom and I have been kicking around, maybe doing something, that's all I can say, together. I'll be back.
Did you mute yourself again?
I'll be back in a second also. Hold on.
Okay. I think I can hear myself. Nope.
Anybody home?
Hello.
All right.
The band's back together.
Okay, I'm going to bring us back and then toss it to you, Emma. Or you can do the "and we're back."
Oh, I get to "and we're back"?
Sure, you're going to do the first little general email?
Yeah, there are 2 emails. There's one from Charlie, there's one from Michael.
Okay, yeah, do Charlie. Well, we'll do them both, but do Charlie first.
Tell me when to go.
3, 2, 1, go! I was going to ask you, Luke, unless it's a total dead end, but in terms of Godzilla...
Yes.
Are there any books, prose, novels, even novelizations of the movies or anything?
There is a novelization of the American Godzilla.
Oh.
Which I have, but I've never read.
Good choice.
There were a couple that were published in the late 90s, but I've never seen them.
Yeah, there's no extended universe, just the comics?
Pretty much.
Interesting.
There's really not much in the way of comics. I mean, you'd think that Godzilla, Toho's very kind of tight-fisted with their properties. So there's never really been a Godzilla manga or anything like that even. So
that's
interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and I know you've made a point in a couple of the episodes that there's some, again, licensing. They're sort of only allowed certain wasn't there one? There was a contradiction where seemed like the name didn't go with the monster, but they had the license to the name and something crazy like that.
Yeah, and in the last couple issues of the second volume of Godzilla, there's, you know, we see the monster Monster X, and Monster X is what is his name, and that's what he's called in his one appearance. Well, Monster X's second form is Kaiser King Ghidorah, or Kaiser Ghidorah, depending on whether you're reading the subtitles or the dub. But if you look at the little license in the inside front cover of all the Godzilla comics, they have these little circular icons that show which monsters are in the book, and this is a requirement from Toho. The Kaiser Ghidorah is called Monster X2 because that was what they called him before the movie Final Wars came out, not so as not to give away the fact that he was.
Ah, right.
So it's like, oh, it's Monster
X2. To avoid spoilers, they gave him a code name.
Yes, but in the book, they still call it Kaiser Ghidorah.
Right. So. Crazy.
Odd.
At the risk of extending the show longer, what is the current state of Hawkman in the DCU?
Actually, fairly straightforward. Hawkman, the Savage Hawkman, was one of the launch titles in the New 52 and established that Hawkman was once again an alien from the planet Thanagar named Katar Hall, who had taken the secret identity of Carter Hall as an Earthman. After his book was canceled, Katar moved over to the Justice League of America title, where he continues to be the burly guy who doesn't say much and gets into big fights using a mace. The only real major changes that came around was that his life on Thanagar was changed quite a bit. He started out as a pit-fighting gladiator, not unlike Conan the Barbarian, and then became a kind of taken in by the royal family, and became a very close consort of the Princess Shiera, to the fact that they were to be married, but then Shiera's brother became the new king, and he was kind of power mad, and it got all kind of King Lear for a little bit in there. And essentially, Katar caused the death of Shiera's brother. And so he fled Thanagar and ended up on Earth, and then eventually Shiera brings an armada of Thanagarian soldiers and bounty hunters to Earth to hunt him down to make him pay for it. So
That was it.
I mean, Savage Hawkman was a very uneven book. It had a lot of different writers over the 20 issues or 21 issues that it existed. But, and again, maybe I'm more prone. But right now, he's currently one of the team ensemble in Justice League of America. I don't know if he's going to stick around once it becomes Justice League Canada when Jeff Lemire takes over. I do know that his old ally from the Silver Age, Adam Strange, is going to be joining the book at that point. So it'd be great to see the two of them teaming up again. The two, the two men out of men from, sort of men from space. I want to say about Adam Strange is that he was a human, but
right.
You know, Earth wasn't really where he was supposed to be. He was supposed to be on Ron. So he was the guy that was like the outsider in his own planet.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of John Carter. I mean, Adam Strange.
Hey, well, you know, hey, if you're gonna ape something, ape the best.
Exactly. No. It could be said that that's what this podcast is all about.
Stealing from better sources.
Hi, Andy. Hi, Mike.
Emily, you don't seem to love Grant Morrison nearly as much.
It would be hard for me too.
I don't think anybody loves Grant Morrison as much as he does.
Ay, ay, ay.
You would think that a lot of, you know, like I said, all these tokusatsu shows and movies, you'd think they would translate perfectly to manga, and the majority of them never do. As far as I know, there's never been like an ongoing Super Sentai manga. And it's like, that is written to be a manga.
That is weird. That's really weird.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do?
Bitch about it on the internet until something happens.
I find that my bitching usually falls on deaf ears. Because most times, like, Jack and Andy, what are you talking about? You know? I remember when I first started doing Earth Destruction Directive, the Two True Freaks, we had a round table, just a random get-together on Skype. And Scott Gardner said to me, he's like, I listened to your show because you asked me to, and I have no idea what it's about, but it was pretty good, so maybe I'll listen to it again. Like, thanks for the rousing vote of confidence.
I mean, to be fair, I'm a big fan of Earth Destruction Directive, and I have not seen any of those movies you talk about. It's possible to still have an engaging show.
We had to look up how to cite an interview in the MLA style handbook. That's a back right there. I think I still have my MLA style handbook somewhere. But
I do not. I graduated and threw it out the window.
I remember throwing a physics textbook out the window once, but that's another story.
Yeah, but that just makes sense.
I remember at the end of the semester, you know, commenting when they get the fill out the course evaluation, comment on the textbook. I want to congratulate the textbook manufacturers for producing a spine that could repeatedly being taken being thrown across the room without breaking. Yeah, one of my favorite characters from there is his. He has a friend of his called Genosuke, who is a rhinoceros that has his horn is cut off to look kind of like like one would cut one's hair.
Mm-hmm.
It's his horn cut very short. Well, Genosuke, he is also a Ronin, but he's kind of like Volstagg the Voluminous. He's got great appetites.
Oh,
so a common story might be that Usagi would run into Genosuke at a tea house, and he would say, "Oh, well, buy me sake and tell me the story of your adventure." Usagi would relate what happened to him on the road. So, it is that if you can find some Usagi Yojimbo, give it a shot. You'll probably like it. All that makes me think of is back in the Halcyon days of Wizard magazine. They used to always say, "Oh, what's a comic you can give to your girlfriend?"
Right.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, it's like, "Oh, okay. Apparently, only straight men and gay women read Wizard magazine. I didn't know that." So, apparently, married people are not allowed to read unless they're talking specifically about their mistresses. But
aside. Now that would be a much more interesting list: comics to give your mistress.
Comics to give your mistress. Yeah. The answer to that question was always exclusively Sandman and Strangers in Paradise. Those were apparently the only two comics that your proverbial girlfriend could read. Now, the first comics I gave my girlfriend that became my wife was there was a Justice League OGN that focused on Wonder Woman called A League of One.
Oh.
Here's a crazy thing, and now stay with me. I'm going to think outside the box here.
Okay.
Examined things my wife was interested in, and what kind of books she was reading and shows she was enjoying, and tried to pick a comic that fit that.
Madness.
I know.
Absolute madness.
I liked magic and mythology and history, and I said, Wonder Woman is all those things. So why don't I try that? And shows how old this was. I went to the DC Comics message board on dccomics.com and said, "What's a good intro to Wonder Woman?" And they said, "Oh, do League of One," and from there I've bought her a lot of different Wonder Woman stuff, but she's read other things as well, and now the answer to that question is always Fables. What do comics give her? Fables. And it's like, I did just give her the first volume of Fables, but that was not the reason why I gave it. It wasn't because an online list said give your girlfriend a copy of Fables to read. It is something that drives me insane. It's like I knew girls in college that loved The Punisher because
yeah.
They wanted just something that they were into, something that was violent with gunplay and a real absurd type of stuff. And it's like, okay, if I give a girl like that a copy of Sandman just because, hey, you're a girl, you must like Neil Gaiman's Sandman, right? I better hope that I've got my running shoes on because I'm going to have to move before I get
She probably has a baseball bat, so
The possession or lack of possession of any anatomical parts should not determine whether or not you like a story, with the exception of some comics do require you to have a brain.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, there are some that don't. Don't get me wrong. I'm reading Shogun Warriors on the podcast, and oh my God, is it amazing, but not
Yeah, my impression of that, just having heard you talk about it a few times, is that it's awesome, but not all that good. That's an important distinction to make. Something can be awesome, but not be great.
let's put it this way. Shogun Warriors wasn't going to win any Eisners, you know?
Yeah.
No doubt about that. But you got a book with three giant robots fighting monsters. It's like, just take my money. You know, it's like Fry says, drama. Shut up and take my money.
Take my money. Yep. That was me in Pacific Rim.
Oh my gosh. Oh my
like,
gosh.
Oh, robots punching monsters and it's directed by Guillermo del Toro? Oh, yes. Would you like all of my money? Here, have it.
Let me put it to you this way. NECA is releasing the toys for Pacific Rim, and I had to force myself to merely get the 6-inch tall Gypsy Danger and Knifehead and not the 18-inch tall Gypsy and Knifehead. It's like I can't do it. Can't pull it off with this. Nope.
See, I'm just saying, mom complains to you, Dad, that, you know, about your little 2-inch tall dooms. It could be worse. It could always be worse.
I have two 2-inch tall Dr. Dooms, and she wouldn't even let me put it. I mean, I chose willingly to take them to the office. I actually think that sets a good tone for my students. I think they know what to expect.
I tell you, right when my wife and I bought our first house, I had gotten. Like I said before, I'm a big G.I. Joe fan. I have a lot of vintage and modern G.I. Joe toys, and I forget who was I put up. I guess it was my original Duke because I just gotten some of my Joes back from my parents, and I put Duke on one of the bookshelves in our living room. And my wife was like, "Why is there a little man standing on my bookshelf?" So, oh, it's Duke, the field commander to the G.I. Joe team. Why is there a little man standing on my bookshelf? I'll move him. Okay, geez. The only one I ever got away with was I have a plush of Mr. Peabody, and I put Mr. Peabody
classic
for many years. And there's actually a Mr. Peabody and Sherman movie coming out next year. It's I have no problem with that being a CG movie.
That is interesting.
I saw that trailer. I said, "Oh, the greatest time traveling hero of all time finally gets a movie." And I said, "What? You thought I meant somebody else? Of course, I mean Mr. Peabody." All right, give me about 2 minutes. I got to make a bottle.